Well, I see you survived the International Congress.
Yes. In fact, I just had breakfast this morning with somebody who was very much involved with it, sort of rehashing the whole thing and the women's issue and all of that.
In fact, you and I sat next to each other at one point.
Did we? Which,
It was in one of the...
We did. I remember that now.
Yeah, I remember because you had a copy of your book.
Sitting on my lap.
Yeah. So I said, I have that book.
Oh, that's interesting.
I have that book, but I hadn't at that point had a chance to read it because it had just been mailed to me. And so I'm glad we had the chance to catch up with each other.
Good.
So some of the stories in here are really good, very delightful. Is this your first book?
This is the first published. I've just signed a contract for two novels, one of which is completed and one of which I'm in the third draft of. So hopefully there will be books to follow soon. But this is the first one between covers that's fiction. I've done nonfiction. I mean, I used to be a reporter, so I had a number of nonfiction things published.
Books?
Well, in books, parts of books. One was called The Challenge of the 70s, and I wrote about race relations in a book that had other issues that were discussed as challenges of the 70s.
The new novel, is the central character Shannon Douglas?
Well, the publisher wants to publish the novel I'm working on now, which is my third novel, first, because it's a much bigger novel. It takes certain of these themes into an international scope, and he thinks that we should come out first with the biggest book, and then he wants to follow with the first novel, which in fact does pick up Shannon Douglas, and is the novel about Shannon Douglas.
You mean the novel you're currently working on?
Will be the first published, and then what is my first novel will be the second published, which is driving my agent crazy trying to get the terms right in the contract.
Well, that could take years.
Well, I'm in the third draft of the novel he wants to publish first, so I hopefully will have it by the fall. The third or the fourth draft, I've lost track. But, I mean, the manuscript is coming close to being done. So we're hoping to have it out by the fall of 87.
That's not an unusual thing to do. Well, I don't know if you need to be published in the book simultaneously, but I remember when Chilly Scenes of Winter by Ann Beattie came out, and what was the other one?
Distortions.
Distortions. Mm-hmm. They came out simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a possibility, maybe.
So with
the first and the second.
Yeah, one drew on the other. Because one was a collection of short stories, and the other was a novel, so it wasn't as though there were two novels competing against each other.
Right. No, that's right. I mean, I have been writing for a decade. I mean, seriously writing 6 days a week, 6 hours a day as a fiction writer. And it sounds terrible and hard, but it just is often the case that you really just write and write and write, and then something breaks through the door, and then another door opens, and you know, you hand them this manuscript and this, and you've written the first three of your books. I'm fortunately in that position right now.
Well, now these short stories in Marble Angels, how did they come about, and how did it happen that Texas Center for Writers Press published them?
Well, the stories, at one point, with my first novel, it was sent to an editor-in-chief of a major house here, which is primarily commercial house and primarily did paperback, but they did have a hardback line. And she wrote back, my agent, said, this is the best book I've read in my whole year and a half here as editor-in-chief, but I'm not publishing it. But she gave nothing wrong with it. And I told my agent, I said, you know, I really want to meet this person. I don't understand. So we had a very nice meeting, and she proceeded to nominate it for some awards. Still didn't publish it, but she said, you know, I really think you should put together a collection of short fiction. That's going to be, I think, a place where you might be able to get into the market. And in a real moment of despair in a rewrite of my second novel, I just couldn't face it, and I put it aside, and I said, I'm going to put together this collection and begin drawing short stories that I'd published, sections from longer work that I thought stood on their own, and put together this collection and sent it to my agent about the same time as a good friend of mine who's the writer and the publisher for the Texas Center for Writers Press, came to town, said, let me see what you've been writing. I haven't read your work in a number of years. And he had published my work before. And he read this collection and said, I want to publish the book. And I was hesitant just because it was a small press. Also, we were good friends, and I wasn't sure. But he really loved the stories, and he had such a love for the stories that I was soon convinced that knowing how hard the publishing market is in fiction, I'd do well to go with somebody who had that feeling for my work. And I had, in between, started learning something about publishing and actually what had to happen other than just having a book in hand, and felt I could work hard for the book after it went between covers. And so this was his first national book. And we moved it into a national market. So it's been about 35 cities all over the country, and it's gotten good national reviews. And, you know, we're both very pleased with how well it's done.
Yes, it has. I have the collection of reviews that the publisher sent, and it did get not only good reviews, but it's a nice thing that a first book is reviewed at all.
At all, that's right. Well, that's really just persistence on the part of sending it out, and then in a few months, if it hasn't made it, sending out information again, perhaps collecting together some of the nice comments, and, you know, then contacting again. It got a nice review in Publishers Weekly, which helped early, and then the New York Times reviewed it early, and clearly those two places helped other reviewers to perhaps see the legitimacy in picking it up and reading it, seeing if they thought it was worth reviewing. And then the LA Times gave it a nice, long, and thoughtful review, which sort of took it the next step.
Now, what is the Texas Center for Writers Press?
It was a press that began about a decade ago in Texas, really to promote regional writing and to give a format. And the press published anthologies of stories and poetry. This is the first book they've ever published just by one author, and just got distribution in the Southwest. And then the publisher, who's also an academic and a writer, moved out of Texas following the job market and ceased publishing for a number of years, and then came back with this book.
Now, where are they?
Well, now they're in Alabama because he teaches in Alabama.
I've noted in Montrose,
that's
Alabama.
Right, that's right.
I was thinking something like Austin or something.
No, well, that would be nice. It's just that's the vagaries of the academic career that that's where he is now.
Because you have links to Texas. You are a Texan.
I am a Texan, and he's a Texan. So I grew up in Dallas, and Texas has been very receptive to this book, and the bookstores especially in Dallas, have been very supportive of the book. They've had me to do readings and signings, etc.
One of the things I noticed in No Marble Angels is that stories take place in differing areas of the country with a lot of different people as well. I mean, here you have Nashville represented. You have a couple of places I haven't quite identified. There's Baltimore, for example. Sounds as though you've gotten around over the years, huh?
Yeah, I left Texas after high school. I was very stirred up. A number of the stories relate to civil rights themes, and I was very stirred up at that time in the South, and went to college in the Midwest, and to graduate school in the East. I lived in Baltimore and Boston, and lived and taught in the universities in New York, and then had moved out to California. So I really hail from many different places, though I think the South is informs a lot of my work and is clearly there in my imagination.
What school in the Midwest did you go to?
I went to a college called Principia. It's a small liberal arts school. Then I went to Johns Hopkins University and then to Brown University for graduate school.
Mm-hmm. Had it always been your intention as you entered higher education to write?
I don't know when. I can remember in college at some point having this dim feeling that I would articulate to nobody that was really what I wanted to do. I had done a lot of journalism in high school. I was a newspaper editor. In college, I was the newspaper editor. So I'd done journalism. But at some point, reading in an American literature course, James Baldwin, I can almost remember the writers, and Walt Whitman in a different course, but just several writers where I really thought that that's what I wanted to do, but would have said so to nobody. It seemed like saying one wanted to walk on the moon, the ambition seemed terrifying. But I began working and began writing and then went and, went to graduate school in the field and realized that it wasn't such a strange place to go. I had no idea how long it took to get there, but it was definitely a destination within reach.
Now, you worked on the Christian Science Monitor. Were you based in Boston at that time?
Yes, I was a reporter during the late 60s and 70s. So I covered a lot of the anti-war movement during that time, a lot of the riots in Harvard Square, and I also covered a lot on desegregation of the schools in Boston during a very hot time.
There's something that seems to be inconsistent between journalism and literature. I mean, people who want to write and who become journalists frequently don't make it as fiction writers or don't try. I don't know what it is, but it all of the people who say, I want to write, and then they go and study journalism, I think they're studying the, when they say, I want to write serious fiction, let's say, and then they go study journalism. It just doesn't seem to come about, except in some rare instances. I mean, Hemingway was a newspaper man, for example, and there are other, William Kennedy up in Albany was a newspaper man, and so there are exceptions. But don't you find journalism, the nonfiction writing, reporting day-to-day events quite different?
Yes.
And almost intimidating if you want to be a fiction writer?
Yeah, it's. I was on a talk show recently, and the interviewer said, well, tell me the transition between journalism and fiction. And I said, about 10 years. Because you really, as a journalist, two things. You're trained to view life and reality differently, standing back as that objective person narrating, and in terms of language, you're using a sort of a flat objective prose, however good it is. You're not inside, and you're looking at events from the outside. In fiction, that I, E-Y-E, really, as well as the I, really does need to turn inward. And both that, I think that psychological change and the language that's needed takes time to develop. I mean, people do it at different rates, but I really found it, you know, it took time. The compression of journalism is takes time to get out of, to learn to expand and, in fact, see what's happening inward. In fiction, you're dealing with the human heart, and in journalism, you're really dealing with the effects of whatever that human heart and individual is doing. But you're not looking at what is inside the person.
Yeah, I've always felt that journalists in general are rather heartless. And I say that
sitting at CBS, right?
Being a journalist myself, I say that because when there is a disaster or there's a tragedy, it usually brings sick jokes in the newsroom. And somehow I don't see fiction writers with the heart, looking at the heart as you described it, doing that. But journalists seem to be very callous.
Well, you do develop. I mean, it was interesting. I've just been visiting with a close friend of mine who's, you know, a journalist in Washington, and, you know, she and I were journalists together, more than 10 years ago. And I realized you develop, you have to develop a certain skepticism of life and power and the ways power works. And I think a good journalist has a very healthy sense of skepticism. It is part of the mental territory. It's not bad as a fiction writer, but at some point it at least changes, or you shed that, because I think you really do take that inward look at the person. You're not questioning whether or not he should be having this position of power, but what is it within him and what's driving that individual interiorly, not to make a judgment on it, but just to see it, to make no judgment or comparison, but just to see, to understand from within.
Now, journalists who make judgments and journalists who get emotionally involved are considered suspect, like this Geraldo Rivera, for example. Within the industry, he was always considered suspect. He was not a real journalist, because a real journalist doesn't break down and cry when he goes and covers a story. He might do it outside if the emotion is that pitched, but you just don't reveal yourself like that. You cover the story as a professional, as a workman. This may be why he's no longer doing that kind of journalism, and maybe he never was. I don't know. I mean, but that is just that's a feeling that most of us have had, not necessarily myself.
But you can't know that you can't feel. It's interesting. My second novel really is two of the main characters. I mean, really the main setting is a newsroom and is journalist, and really goes into that theme of at what point the heart takes you beyond, so you really are not responsible to your profession, and what is that line of the human heart? And it's very hard sometimes if you're dealing with issues that have emotional weight for you to make that distance. But over time, because you're dealing in a job, you just are inundated with things to cover as anybody is, and you have to get heartless or you can't get them all done. I mean, you just have to cover this story and this story and this story, and it begins to be flattened, I think, sometimes.
What was Baltimore like?
I was in Baltimore as a graduate student at Johns Hopkins, and I really began to know two worlds. I, you know, worked at the university and, you know, stayed in the library. Also taught at the community college. And then I also became very close with a family in Baltimore, a black family, through tutoring and really going into their home. And that was a time in the late 60s where that was an issue I was very emotionally involved in, was civil rights, and began to try to break through a lot of barriers that I felt I had just psychologically and begin to understand myself first and why those barriers were there. And so Baltimore is a very formative place for me in the beginning of a long road.
But you lived in a house where there was kind of a creepy photographer?
No, you know, the house in the stories. No, but it's interesting. After I did the first draft of the novel, which is often the case, at least in my writing, you know, you write from the imagination, and then you have to go confirm your imagination. You have to, in fact, as there is a strong journalist in me that emerges in the second draft and says, yes, but is this right, this right, this right. That journalist is really not there in the first draft because that's just writing it. And so I then went to Baltimore and rented a room in a rundown boarding house and stayed there for a week. And a lot of that really fine-tuning and feelings came from that stay. But it was a specific going to stay to make sure that the story I had conceived had the that texture and depth that it needed. But I was in the graduate housing at Johns Hopkins when I lived there.
What years were you in Baltimore?
I was in living full-time 68, 69.
I worked there myself for a while, but I missed you. I did miss you. I came up here in 67 from Baltimore. I lived near Johns Hopkins on Calvert Street.
Oh, did you? Oh. I was just back there last week. In fact, last Friday, Johns Hopkins is having its 40th anniversary for the writing program. And
were you in the writing program?
I was in the writing program there.
Was John Barth involved at that time?
He wasn't. The anniversary actually is going to be this fall, but they're talking about bringing writers back in, doing readings. No, he wasn't. Elliot Coleman, who started the program, was still there running it. He was the poet and a fiction writer called Joseph Whitehill. And Barth came, I think, the year or the year after I graduated.
Well, there's quite a literary tradition in Baltimore, isn't there?
There
and
is.
Rice is writing down there.
Ann Tyler is a wonderful...
Ann Tyler.
Right.
And of course, when I was there, Ogden Nash lived
is that right?
Just a few blocks away from me, in fact. And, of course, everybody knows about Poe and Mencken and Hemingway.
Hold on. The graveyard that is in the story of imagination also has Sidney Lanier and has a number of writers buried in that graveyard.
I understand William Styron met his wife in Baltimore.
Is that right? Yeah, it's an interesting city. It always has sort of lived in the shadow of Washington, D.C., I think. But as you begin to get into it, I found it a very interesting and a city in which I learned a lot.
I liked it a lot when I was there because I always came from. I was worked in small towns before, or medium-sized cities. So going to Baltimore, it was like a breath of fresh air.
The big city.
Yeah, yes. I remember going down to see the block. All three or four blocks of it, and I was really overwhelmed. I thought, I'll come down here every night.
That's right.
Sit there and watch the strippers come out and have a dollar and a half beer. But after two nights...
It wasn't that much
No, after two nights, I was tired of the dollar and a half beers, and the girls began to look alike, and so I...
Yeah, that part isn't in my book. I missed that. I mean, I didn't miss it. I didn't spend too much time on the block, though.
But I was reading an article in the New York Times, and it's... there's hardly any block left anymore because of municipal expansion and development.
Renovation.
Yeah.
Of that, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about some of the writers that you like to read.
Contemporary writers. A lot of them. I always wish I had more time right at this point to read. I have a whole list to catch up with. But I like a writer called Rosellen Brown very much. Paul Marshall wrote a wonderful book called The Timeless Place, The Chosen People. I read, I'm trying now really to backfill a lot of the classics that I've wanted to read, including Russian and English and French writers. I'm trying to think of who else. It's hard on. Steinbeck, a lot. Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. I've probably read so many times I can't read the print on the page anymore. And
I think I'm going to wait till I'm retired before I start the classics.
The classic.
I can barely keep up with my... reading and writing as it is. You're living in Los Angeles now, huh?
That's right.
How did you find your way out there?
Well, I moved out about 8 years ago. My husband's profession moved him out there, and I was a writer and a college teacher, and that's a fairly mobile profession at that time. And so I started teaching in Occidental College out there and was writing, finishing my first book, I think, about that time. And I'm now teaching part-time in the writer's program at UCLA.
You have children?
Still writing. I have a 6-year-old and an 8-year-old.
Do they give you a moment's peace so you can write?
It's difficult. I was just speaking with an editor this morning, and I was saying, in many ways, I think my third book I will dedicate to them because I probably wouldn't have persisted had I not had them. It's so hard to write so long and have so little echo of yourself that I think I might just have gone back to a career at the end of the second book, except I had these wonderful children I wanted to spend time with. So they both helped me to finish it, and at the same time, I felt like a long-distance runner doing wind sprints, because I would have 3 hours a day, and I could have written 8 hours a day or 1 hour a day. But they grew up now. They're in school, and I have that time. You know, I probably have 6 hours a day I write regularly.
Yeah. I see you have a place marked in the book. Is there something you wanted to discuss on?
Oh, no. Yes, I can. I just had places marked that I felt discuss some of the themes of the stories, and so I'm sometimes ready to read. I can, if you're speaking in Baltimore, maybe I'll just read a little bit. That Shannon Douglas is the protagonist of the three first stories in the book, as you know, and she's moved from Raleigh, North Carolina, to Baltimore after college, really to find, to break with that sense of isolation of her past and those gaps she feels in her own background in the culture. She really does want to make those bridges, white and black, between white and black culture, between men and women. And this is just one of her rationales as she's in Baltimore walking the streets. She had come here from Raleigh, North Carolina, where her father lived in a sprawling white house in an all-white enclave of the city. She had come after college graduation to break with her past and create herself from that which she was not. She had also come to help, though who or how she would help, she wasn't sure, and she wouldn't have argued that it was also herself she was helping, for she wanted to close the distance between who she was and who she might become, between the experience handed her and the experience she must seek for herself. And I think a lot of the stories in the book are really looking towards that created experience and that need to make those bridges with oneself and the other, however that other might define themselves, racially or sexually or in terms of age, young and old. And so I have marked several passages that I felt really were trying to get at the core of what the book is about, because it does span times and it spans places. But I think that theme is fairly central to a lot of the stories.
They're very nice stories, Joanne. The book is from a small press, but is it getting... How's it being distributed? Most of the bookstores have access to it?
Yes, we got both Baker & Taylor and Ingram's Book Companies, which are the two major national distributors in the country, to take on the book. And we really did that. At first, we were reluctant because it is a small press and it was my first book. But we really then went out to bookstores in, you know, lots of cities, sent them flyers and information, and it's got good advance comments from some writers who were helpful, well-known, established writers, and then it also got early good reviews. And went out to them, and they said, well, we'll order it if Baker & Taylor or Ingram's take it. And then we went back to Baker & Taylor and Ingram and said, well, we have these, you know, 100 bookstores who want to order it. And they said, okay, we'll take it. So it's available. The press is targeted because has really targeted Los Angeles, Dallas, and New York as the three cities they've spent time promoting the book. But it is in probably 35 cities.
And, of course, you mentioned 800 numbers, so I guess people can call for it, huh?
Yes.
Okay.
It's 1-800-852-5000.
We'll see if we can get that in.
Okay, yeah, that's all
right. Don't count on it.
I won't count on it.
Well, it's a nice book, and it's a good start for you. I'm certainly going to look forward to your additional stuff. Is there a timetable for the
novel? Well, if I could, I've signed a contract for two books, and
who's the publisher?
The publisher is Saybrook, which is distributed through Norton, a relatively new publisher who's published nonfiction. He's published Rollo May, and there's a book by Norman Cousins coming out, and is just starting into fiction. And I've told him I think I can have it, the manuscript to him by this fall, which would mean the book would come out fall 87, the first novel. I mean, the first novel he'll publish. And the next
one
would be...
You've got to guard your 6 hours a day of privacy.
Very much. I mean, I'm really not going to be teaching during the summer, and I'm really writing on a hard schedule to finish that, but I think I'll be able to do it.
Well, Joanne Lita Mackerman, thank you very much for stopping in and talking to me about No Marble Angels.
Thank you.
I'll look forward to the other stuff when it comes out.
Okay, good.